G'day folks, welcome to Stick With It, APA's podcast for its pilots. With the training slots all being released and many of you preparing for that part of your journey in Qantas, I thought it would be interesting to explore a bit of the background of, you know, the inner voice that we have when we undertake training and what we tend to tell ourselves, and a bit of, I guess, the psychology behind who we are as pilots and our approach to training. So I'm very lucky to have with me today Andrew Stewart. Andrew is a former Qantas captain who is since retired, but has also been working in PAN and has also gone off to do qualifications in the psychotherapist area and mindfulness. So he's going to be here today to give us some thoughts from his perspective on how, I guess, we can maybe be a bit kinder to ourselves, and also to give us some tips and tricks as to how to successfully navigate and manage our training journey. So welcome to you, Andrew.
G'day. Thanks for having me.
Now, can you just give us a bit of a brief synopsis initially of your career in Qantas?
Yeah, sure. Look, I started in, I think it was November 85, as a second officer on the Classic. And in those days, you know, we all had a standard way that we progressed to the rank. So it was sort of second officer on the Classic, then FO767, FO74, 7400, 767 captain, 747 captain. That's how it went. So Classic, 767, and 747-400.
Nice.
Which, yeah, they don't, a few of those airplanes don't really exist anymore.
No, they're all gone. Now, I also believe you've been involved with PAN. What's how long have you been working with PAN, and in what capacity?
Yeah, so I am, well, the official capacity is the sort of the therapist slash counsellor for the PAN organisation. And so guys will call me up if they've got issues. I mean, we can talk about how PAN works if you like, but basically I've been there for about, or maybe 3 years now, August 2021. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we've got this triage system where basically the PAN pilots will make contact with somebody, and then they'll, you know, depending on what the situation is and who the person is, they'll either spend time with them and be able to handle it on their own, or they'll, you know, refer it on to maybe a state coordinator in PAN, or they'll refer it on to me and then I can refer it on to other people. So it's a pretty good system.
Okay. Yeah, we might touch on that a little bit later, just once we get through the chat. So why did you decide to explore the pathway of psychotherapist and then sort of moving into that mindfulness stuff? What was your reason to go into that area?
Well, look, I've always been interested in this sort of commonalities between Western science and Eastern philosophy. And so I was trying to look for, you know, areas that would combine the two. I started off doing a degree in counselling and psychotherapy way back, I think it was 2005, and then it was part-time. So I finished about 2010, and then, you know, I was able to do that. Some of it was on campus and some of it was online, so you can do the, you know, the assignments in the middle of the night in London when you're wide awake. So that all worked very well. And after that degree, I decided to, well, in Qantas, you know, eventually it got to the point where I was doing a lot of long-haul stuff and it was starting to, you know, I really didn't like all the jet lag and it was starting to impact my health, in fact. So I thought I need to do something else. So I left the company a little bit early and then decided to pursue another degree, ended up going to the UK to do a master's in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy at Oxford. And so that's pretty much the journey of training and going back to university. But I think the reason, you know, you asked about why, I remember it started off way back when I was a young second officer with a company. And on one of my very first trips to London, you know, I was very excited about the trip. We had a great crew on the first leg. The captain was very animated talking about when he was getting to London, he was going to spend a lot of time with this, you know, long-haired friend, which was his description. and he was very excited about that and, you know, spent a lot of time and, you know, effort organizing this trip. There was, you know, flights. When we got to London, he was going to jump straight on a plane. They were going to go to another country. They had trains and, you know, hotels and buses and whatever, all planned. But, of course, the inevitable happened when we got to Singapore and we had a delay. And what was fascinating to me was watching this, you know, this person, literally it was a Jekyll and Hyde situation where he turned into a bit of a threat to the operation and he became very aggressive towards everybody, you know, the flight attendants, the engineers, ground crew, everybody, because his primary agenda was getting to Europe on time to meet all these, you know, all the things that he planned for months for, to have this holiday with his friend. And so it was very interesting to see that. And then, of course, you know, it got to the point where it was threatened that we might have to spend the night in Singapore, which really upset him. And what was interesting to me was that when things like, you know, the concept of threat and error management came in, I suddenly realized that we looked at threats like, you know, bad weather or air traffic control. We weren't really thinking about the internal threat, so the psychological threat of somebody who's been impacted by something in their life that then carries through to the operation, you know, of the crew. So that's really what kicked it all off for me.
Okay. Oh, well, I look forward to exploring that a bit more through the chat. So I guess to start with, I'm interested in your thoughts on, you know, some personality characteristics that are common to professional aviators and I guess what they are and how they keep us safe.
Well, yeah, look, I think we do have some common characteristics. I mean, you know, pilots are drawn from a wide range of areas now. It's all about diversity and inclusion, I guess, these days. But in general, you know, we tend to be ambitious, achievement-orientated, driven, intelligent, problem-solving individuals. And that's, you know, that's obviously a really good thing to have in the flight deck. And also, I think the cultural attitude that we have in Australia, you know, this sort of flattening of the hierarchy scenario, maybe associated with tall poppy syndrome. So that opens up the, you know, flight deck for things like crew resource management and being able to, you know, being happy with challenging somebody if you don't feel good in the scenario. But, you know, there is, I think that keeps us safe because it keeps the crew mentality going. We're all very similar. I remember when, you know, guys went off to training in the US years ago, and the guys there, you know, said that we were a really homogenous group. We all did things at exactly the same time and exactly the same way. And I think that's very helpful. And socialization too is a big component of that. So if we know that if you're socializing with people and you get to know them really well, then if you have an emergency situation, you're going to perform well as a team. But it does have some, you know, it has some limitations in the sense that a little bit of perfectionism can creep into that. We all want to be doing the best that we can do, and sometimes that can become a bit of an obstacle in a training scenario or in a simulator scenario.
So yes, moving into that, I guess those personality characteristics keep us safe when we fly. Do they help or potentially, as you say, be a hindrance to us when we undertake a training course?
Yeah, so I think they're helpful in the way that, you know, we can operate as a crew, and certainly when things are getting tough. You know, if you're really driven and you have a really strong intention about, you know, where you're going, you know, for some guys, well, like myself, I had this picture of a 747 cockpit with a, you know, and I had this focus on the left-hand seat. So if you've got an intention there and you're driven and you're motivated and you're ambitious, then it's going to push you through those tough challenges that may come up during training. But if also, you know, we have this sense of, if there's a perfectionism element to it, we have the sense of wanting to be in control. And if something starts to go wrong in training, then that can be, you know, a scenario where people can start to generate a very negative thought stream fairly quickly, where something that we call the, you know, the self-critic emerges. And that can be very demotivating and stress-inducing. And I think if you talk to some of the trainers, they'll say that for some people, the biggest obstacle can just be themselves. And I think that's one of the things that can happen, you know, for people who are struggling in their training. And this also for people who've never really struggled before, you know, parts of their personality or their characteristics or schemas that, you know, we call them schemas, that these patterns that are built up over time can start to emerge that you haven't seen before. So it's very hard to know what to do with that if you haven't seen them before. And so for this type of personality characteristic, you know, you can have these layers of self-doubt that might be hiding beneath the surface or have emerged in the past for different things, and they can come up and can be re-triggered when the, you know, the body-mind system is under stress, which is what happens in the training system. You know, it's designed to put you under stress to see how you perform. So it can be a bit of a challenge.
I'm curious with part of that as well, as you said, that perfectionism element where, you know, if you're doing a training course, the expectation at the start of the course is you're not, you know, you will evolve and hopefully grow to be competent and proficient by the end of the training course. But for some people, I guess, with that perfectionism mindset, they expect to achieve that on day one. Is that, how do you, what would you say to people who potentially have that in terms of how to manage you know, that process of, you know, you're not expected to be proficient and competent on day one?
Yeah, so look, I would be inviting to let go or to just pay attention to this, you know, how strongly they place an emphasis on being in control, because, you know, when we tend to have this sense of control throughout our lives. It's how we operate. It's what we do. It's what we need to do if we're, you know, flying an aircraft. But that suddenly gets taken away from you if you don't, you know, tick the boxes or achieve what you think you were going to achieve in a training program. And for some people, that can really impact you. And as I say, if you're not used to, you know, to having that happen, it's really about being open-minded. I think you have to be positive when you come up to training. You certainly have to have had the work, you know, done the work in terms of book work to get yourself ready and get all those other things. You know, we used to say that phrase, get all your ducks in a row, no financial issues or relationship issues. But things can and do go wrong. And I tend to see the people who have tripped up somewhere and are really struggling with some emotional stuff that has come up as a result of, you know, missing out on training. We know that one of the major drivers of mood disorders in the therapy world, particularly in areas like depression, is this very strong negative internal monologue that starts. And in fact, it's one of the first things that's targeted when people are struggling to get out of, you know, or prevent relapse with people with things like depression. So it's a real problem. And I think it's the surprise element. You know, it's a bit like the startle effect. You're just not expecting things to go wrong. We certainly wouldn't expect things to go wrong. I mean, some people do come to training if they've got a lot of self-doubt that's come from other areas in their life, or they've had a training program before which they've had some trouble getting through, then they're already going to be kind of on the back foot, or if this is the second time when they're having a go at training. But something that I notice with people that come and talk to me after they've been through, you know, really serious challenges, they often talk around it, but they don't face it directly. And what they're talking about often is this concept of shame. And that's a big one that we look at a lot, that is something that can drive the mood into this place and really feed that, you know, that self-doubt and that lack of confidence. Because, of course, in our system, you know, if somebody fails a training program, the problem is, or the reality is, they go back to the same position that they started in. So if you're going to do command training, you go back to being a first officer. And of course, everybody can see that. People who knew that they were going to do their training can see that they haven't gotten through. So there's no hiding it. You know, the company knows, the colleagues know, the family knows, everybody knows. And not only that, every time they go to work, you know, they have to face somebody, they'll inevitably have a conversation about, you know, you must be due for training, or if they don't know them, or if they do know them, how did the training go? So they have to, you know, go through that process again and again and again. So I think, you know, it's very difficult to prepare for that. And I mean, your question was based around how people can prepare for that. I think you just need to be doing the work and just come with an open mind and you know, be aware of the fact that things won't go exactly, may not go exactly as planned. And if they don't, then have some kind of, you know, things in place to deal with that when that happens.
So with that, you talked about that internal monologue. I find interesting, as you said, the tall poppy aspect a little bit, where we're very reluctant to stick our head above our colleagues. You know, this thing of saying, you know, I'm the best pilot. I mean, that's not what we do. But equally, mm-hmm. Often there's, you know, people say, I hope I pass this course, or I hope I don't fail. And then that feeds into, as you said, that sort of negative monologue that might be inside your head. And then, as you said, you might have a bit of a struggle. What are some ways or what are some ways to try and, I guess, manage or deal with that negative internal monologue and maybe flip it around a little bit and be a bit kinder to yourself?
Yeah, so look, there are many ways to do that in therapy. I think one of the first ways that we do it, certainly when I talk to guys, you know, having emotions and feelings that they are not familiar with, is a little bit of what we would call psychoeducation. So helping people to understand what, you know, what's going on and what factors are at play. And in the training environment, you know, there's a whole number of influences that can impact what happens in training. You know, most of these symptoms are well hidden until we're under stress. And when we're under stress, we get into that fight flight mode, that sense of there being a threat, and the threat being the possibility of failure or things going wrong. There's all that negativity that happens. And in the world of, you know, therapy, as I mentioned, you know, mood disorders before, one of the first things that happens, like the big driver of a mood disorder like depression, is this something they call automatic negative thinking. And that just takes off naturally. And for some people, the triggers are very, very small. Like if someone gets invited to lunch, for example, and then on the day of the lunch, it's cancelled, the person who may be oriented towards being depressed or anxious will suddenly start to create this negative narrative about why the lunch was cancelled. And they don't really believe the reason that it was cancelled, or that there's something wrong with them, or that somebody doesn't like them, or nobody likes them. And off they go down this spiral of negativity. So one of the things that we do is we target that straight away. And the way we target that is to, first of all, make people aware that they have this negative monologue going on, and then direct their attention somewhere else. And one of the first successful ways to direct attention away from the internal monologue of the mind or the story or the thoughts is to direct it into the body. And that's where mindfulness comes into play. And one of the things that happens when you're having a negative thought stream is you're projecting into the future about how things are going to go wrong or potentially could go wrong, or reflecting on the past where they've already gone wrong, as you would, describe them. So there's this mental time travel about all the things that have happened and all the things that will happen. And as soon as you bring your attention into the body and you focus on your senses, you're going to come into the present moment and all that negative time travel stops. So if you think about your senses, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, hearing, it's all and only always in the present moment. So suddenly that negative thought process of time travel stops. Of course, that takes a lot of practice. So with mindfulness training, we get people to get onto programs where they can start to, to practice this, because what happens with attention, and let me know if I'm going on too long with this, but I can talk about it this for hours.
No, it's really interesting.
Sorry?
It's very interesting.
Okay, so attention is one of those things that is partially under control and partially not. And as in an airplane, we've got in the old Boeings, we would have the ICAS system, and if something goes wrong, then we've got the lights going off and we've got the sounds going off, and our attention is drawn to it straight away. But in an emotional scenario, if we're ruminating over something that's gone wrong or something that we anticipate is going to go wrong, then we can go back over and over and over and over it again forever. And the trick is to be able to train that attention, train the mind to bring that attention just towards something else and away from the rumination. And that's very much a part of what mindfulness does. It's mind training. It's training the brain to do what you want it to do. Because as you know, the way the brain works, the way the mind works, if you've got an intention to, say, study for a simulator, the moment you sit down, your thoughts immediately go to, oh, what about that box set of White Lotus? Or I could be out surfing, or I could be, whatever it is. So the attention starts to wander. And with mindfulness training and helping people to step away from the rumination that's associated with depression, we get them to train their attention to focus on something else.
So in the maelstrom of a training course, is mindfulness something that you can learn quickly, or is it something that you can evolve eventually over time, or are there apps, or is it books people can read, or is it talking to someone like yourself through PAN? What would be the best way, for someone who may be anxious and struggling with their training, who thinks that mindfulness might be something that helps them? What's the pathway, to starting to look at that as an option to them?
Yeah, well, we would certainly recommend that people would, start on things like apps. I mean, there's so many apps out there. You can just Google mindfulness and, apps like Headspace, Calm, Insight Timer, 10% Happier, Healthy Minds. There's a whole bunch of them. And also there's books. I think for me, certainly it started off by reading books. I was reading books by someone called Jon Kabat-Zinn, who started off in the 70s, I think. He was helping people who came out of a medical situation where they'd had an operation, or they're recovering from their operation, or they were struggling with, cancer diagnosis, that sort of stuff. And he started this program called mindfulness-based stress reduction, and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is an offshoot of that. That's the one I studied. But it's a very common program. It's an 8-week program, and it's all around the world. And basically they've discovered that it takes about eight weeks to embed mindfulness into the system. So that's why it takes, they've settled on that time period. But he did write some books. One of them was called Full Catastrophe Living, another Mindfulness for Beginners. Mark Williams, my professor at Oxford, wrote a book called Finding Peace in a Frantic World. There's plenty of books out there. So if you start Googling the books and Googling the apps, I think that's a good place to start. And then if you're really serious, you can start going on some courses to help you kind of, you know, embed the practice. Because like anything, it is a practice. And that's the difficulty when people come to me, you know, if they failed a training program, it's, you know, they've already failed it. And it takes time for them to build up this mindfulness practice. But you can certainly start to pay attention to what's going on in your mind and in your body. And that's really, you know, that's the first step.
So it feels, as you said, it's almost focusing on that, the mindfulness side of things and the immediate things around you. And obviously what that then takes you away from those negative thoughts. And is that sort of what we're getting at in terms of it just removes the negative thoughts, or is it distracting you from the negative thoughts? How would you couch it?
Yeah, so it's not, you know, that's a bit of a misunderstanding about mindfulness, that we're going to get rid of all the negative thoughts. So basically the first thing that we're going to do is, if you're going to start a mindfulness program, we're going to start meditation. So mindfulness is, you know, coming to every event in life with a little bit more attention and a little bit more awareness. So doing things mindfully. And the way you do that is through meditation. Now, meditation doesn't mean necessarily sitting in the lotus position and wearing orange robes. It can be sitting outside, you know, looking at the sunset, going for a walk. Some people do it swimming, whatever it is. What you're starting to do is pay attention to what's going on internally as well as externally. And one of the first ways that we invite people to do this is to focus on something that they can focus on internally, like the breath. So when somebody starts to focus on the breath, that's their intention, right? So the initial intention is to focus on the breath. And then what happens is, if anybody tries that, you'll notice straight away that your mind will just wander off. I mean, it's too boring, basically.
Yep.
Because we're distracted by so many things every day. If you're invited to focus on the breath, you're just not going to sit there and do it. So what you do then is you notice that the mind has wandered away. You acknowledge that and you gently bring it back to the breath. And you do this over and over and over again. We like to say it's like training a puppy. So if you're going to train a puppy to sit, the puppy, you know, you bring it over to and put it down on the floor, and then it gets up and wanders away. And then you gently bring it back and put it on the floor, and it gets up and wanders away, and you gently bring it back. So that's the way it works. And what you're doing is training the attention system. You're training the focus of attention to hold it in place while, you know, everything's going on. And this can be very useful in places like the simulator, because if you, say, make a mistake in the simulator, and you can start thinking about it and think, well, did he see that? Or maybe he didn't see that. Or I wonder if he saw that. I better not make another one. I've got, you know, engine out ILS with whatever coming up. I don't want to screw that up because I've already made one mistake. And what if I make another mistake? And so the mind can be doing all of that instead of focusing on the task at hand. And what this sort of training does is enable you to strengthen that ability to focus on the task at hand. The second thing that it does is primarily is that it just dampens down the emotional overwhelm that can occur. So it's a bit like if you go to a movie, like the latest Tom Cruise movie that most pilots would probably have seen, very powerful, very emotional, you know, you're sort of on the edge of your seat and you're really involved in the movie and it has a big emotional punch. However, if you see the movie the second time or the third time, it won't have as much emotional punch. And then, of course, if you see it 20 times, it's hardly going to have any impact at all. This is the same thing when we start to pay attention to our internal monologue or our internal emotions. What we're trying to do is create this sort of metaphorical distance between you that's observing the emotion or the monologue and the actual object of your observation. And once you create that distance between you and that, eventually over time it reduces so you're not overwhelmed by this emotion. And this is particularly important for people who have, you know, had a hiccup in training and they're struggling with self-confidence issues, just to kind of enable them to distance themselves a little bit from that so that they're not being overwhelmed by it. So there's a lot of ways that mindfulness can help, and it certainly helps in terms of, you know, productivity and performance in things like the simulator.
And I think that the thing you just raised before about, you know, you make a mistake in the sim and then, as you said, you're wondering if they notice it, and then what I'm interested to get a bit more, explore that a bit more with you. I remember when I did my command training, you know, when you're online and you're actually, you know, you have a sector and it didn't go as well, or you made some mistakes, and then you're on the ground trying to turn the aircraft around and go back to somewhere else. And it's that ability to compartmentalize what's happened so that you can be in the moment and not let that then sort of snowball into subsequent errors, which actually just makes the whole thing worse. So I'm curious about, as you said, both either sim or line training, that that capacity to be able to park an error, deal with it later, and then still be back in the moment for what you have to do there and then. So again, I'm just interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it comes back to the same idea of what the attention is doing, because your attention is going to wander back to that error or whatever you did during the flight that you weren't happy with. And if you have a different task that you're trying to focus on, this is a skill that's, you know, can be very useful to enable you to focus on that task. So it is attention training or concentration training. I mean, they use it in, you know, in military areas where they teach people, you know, snipers and whatever, to focus their attention more. And it's the same sort of thing. You know, there's this, I won't get too technical, but there's something called the default mode network in the brain that operates, which is involved. It's kind of, you know, something we call self-referential processing. So it's involved in self-reflection, the sort of mental time travel, you know, that ability to worry about the future and regret the past. And mindfulness has been shown to dampen down this default mode network so that you're not constantly running this narrative, or you're not, you know, having that attention wander back to that problem that you thought about. And it really does improve the focus. But I mean, apart from everything else, what you're really starting to pay attention to everything that's going on. We tend to operate, you know, through life really ignoring a lot of things that are happening in the body mind. It's just not important enough. It's only when things start to go wrong then all those, you know, things come into play. I mean, you can notice what happens. The body's always interacting with the mind all the time. When I first started, you know, learning about this, I remember we used to blast off from Singapore at sort of 2 a.m, head out over the Bay of Bengal. And if it was monsoon season, you just would have this, you know, your entire radar would be red or magenta, and scary stuff in the middle of the night when you're feeling very tired, especially if you haven't had a good nap in the afternoon. And if you pay attention to the body subtly goes into threat mode, because there it is all out there. And you can notice that your heart rate's gone up a little bit. You notice that your body temperature's up a bit. Your palms might be a bit sweaty. And all those things are just a natural response to, you know, a threat in the environment. So when you start to pay attention to all of that and you notice everything that's happened on a regular basis, it just doesn't have the impact that it used to have before. It's the same with being able to compartmentalize, you know, your mistakes or your errors, that you can actually put them aside. They're not such big things, because it's the fact that they're, you know, they're big red light flashing issues in your mind that draw you back to them over and over again. And you're able to compartmentalize those if you don't see them in that way, if you're able to bring your focus to whatever that you need to be doing at the time without constantly going back to, you know, revisiting those errors.
Do you think, because obviously, you know, people pass probably more than fail. So, you know, some people might say, well, I don't need this stuff in my life. You know, I've managed to cobble it together through my training. Do you think back on your career, would it have been more enjoyable or easier if the skills that you now have, you'd had through that process? I'm just wondering, you know, the group of us that go, well, I don't need that. Oh, I'm all right. Thanks, Jack. But I'm just wondering if, as a group, you know, that with this, it's almost like, see, you know, in the evolution of pilots, is mindfulness something that would actually make our jobs more enjoyable and actually make us more productive?
Look, I think it very much is. Talk about it now in terms of, not in terms of, you know, mental health issues, but in terms of human flourishing. So, you know, some people believe that it's going to be very much like, you know, 100 and how many years ago when we introduced hygiene standards and lifespan kind of improved by about 50% or thereabouts. And they feel it's going to be the same way with mental health and human flourishing from a you know, a mind perspective. So absolutely. And I think it's not, you know, it's not about, some people think it's about making you sort of a very bland, equanimous type person where nothing upsets you, and it's really not the case at all, because in fact you're able to enjoy things more from the point of view that you're not worried about them ending, or you're not thinking about, you know, something else in the future. You're totally completely present with whatever's happening, you know, at the time. And one of the other side benefits, of course, I think you mentioned earlier on, this idea of, you know, kindness, self-kindness, something we don't think about and most pilots wouldn't even, you know, dream about. But I do see that in guys and girls that come, you know, to Pan that are just so, that have been beating themselves up so much. And the idea of self-kindness doesn't even occur to them. But we know now from literature that it's very, very powerful in terms of helping people recover from, you know, serious stressful situations. So it's I think it's self-compassion as well. I wanted to mention too that that's something that wasn't in the literature, the psychology literature a few years ago, but now it's also very, very prominent. And so those, you know, yes, of course, there's going to be people who, and I was one of those people too, you know, very traumatic events that happened in my life. And when things are going well, you just don't even think about it. And you, and I'm not sure that you really need to think about it, but it's a bit like, you know, preparations. The way we're trained in the company, most of the time when we go to work, everything goes tickety-boo, there's no issues. But the way we're trained so that when things go pear-shaped, we're ready for them. And it's the same thing with this, because, I mean, if you're going to get through life, you know, 80 or 90 years of life, and everything's going to go perfectly, well, that's going to be a very rare thing. So I think it's very helpful to be prepared in a way that we can be prepared for black swan events. And we've just seen that recently with COVID and how people coped with that. Because, you know, one of the things that we know in psychology is that the human condition is that people tend to want to turn away from the unpleasant and turn towards the pleasant. It's very natural, very common. And people would say to me, well, why would you want to turn towards the unpleasant? Well, one of the reasons turning towards the unpleasant is that you might want to start building some tolerance there or building some resilience. You know, that idea of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, because that's what we need. We need that in flying and we need that in life in general. And mindfulness is one of those things can help you build that that sort of resilience to life.
I'll ask you a question about COVID in a minute, but just to finish on what you said before about sort of self-kindness or compassion, are there some ideas of how people can do that? Is in terms of, is that, does that again fill into that mindfulness sort of area, or is that a different thing in terms of some language people can use to themselves or an approach to themselves? What do you have any advice on, I guess, how maybe we can be a bit kinder to ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. Mindfulness is very much about, you know, self-kindness or self-compassion. In fact, self-compassion, the definition is, you know, of there are three components. This is Kristen Neff's work. And the three components are mindfulness. So it's to be, the first one is mindfulness. So to be aware of the fact that you're habitually being self-critical and not in a constructive way, but in a destructive way. And then the second component is self-kindness. And the third component is common humanity. And this is one, you know, one of the things that I see often when people come to therapy or they come to PAN is that they think they're the only one, you know, that has failed, or the only one that experiences shame, or the only one that is really suffering. So to understand from a self-compassion point of view that you're not alone, and that self-kindness is definitely one of the steps to help with that. Now, for a lot of guys, the idea of self-kindness is very challenging. In fact, not because, you know, they've got big egos or because they're, you know, they couldn't be bothered, but simply because they've never really practiced it or thought about it. So it's one of those things that does need to be practiced. And in mindfulness, it is something that's cultivated. And instead of going straight to, you know, kindness, or in some Eastern philosophies, they talk about loving kindness, which is a bit foreign for us in the West, perhaps, even though I've got family members that are from Asia. But my point is that it's difficult for people to sort of be kind to themselves. So we invite them to be a little bit more friendly. We, in fact, the term we use is a friendly curiosity. And that friendly curiosity applies to everything that's happening around them and everything that's happening within them. Having a bit of a more open attitude towards the self. And yes, as you say, there are compassion practices that people do where they might say phrases to themselves like, you know, may I live with ease, may I be at peace, may I be happy. For some people that works, and for some people that doesn't. But, you know, there's so many stories. And again, you won't think about needing it or see it or seeing it until, you know, things go wrong. I often help people with, you know, I work with some of the people who are struggling with cancer diagnosis. And, you know, they're all, it always comes back to this childlike attitude of there is in theory this, you know, this, we don't talk about it too much these days, but an inner child that's looking for the same things all the time throughout their life, you know, am I being loved? Am I being taken care of? Am I being seen? Am I being recognized? And, you know, we're trying to be, if people can't find kindness, I try to invite them to think about their, you know, their six-year-old self and how you would be to them. And often, you know, you hear people, certainly when I came out of the simulator, if I'd had a poor performance, I would say, oh, you know, it was terrible. Or if I knew it wouldn't go too well because I didn't study that well, then, you know, next time I probably won't do well either because I probably won't study well for that either, or whatever the dialogue is. And if you invite people to think about whether if they'd phoned their best friend and they said that to them, you know, how would that feel? So we recognize then that we have a voice that's very critical, and we don't understand that we can turn that voice around and make it very supportive, and make it very kind. So it's really about educating people. And the first step really is just to pay attention. What's going on? Oh, yeah, I am beating myself up every time I come out of the sim, or every time I do this or whatever it is, or I have an argument with my spouse. Yeah, I'm being aggressive towards myself. Isn't that interesting? Okay. And that's a very important point, not to suddenly go into judgment. I shouldn't be doing that, or that's really bad, but isn't that interesting, right? So just to notice that, and then that's the first step in starting to change it.
Okay. Now with COVID, so obviously, as you said, black swan event, you know, everyone was, you know, running for lifeboats and obviously everyone handled it differently. Do you think that's had a long-lasting impact on, or has that permanently sort of almost impacted the psyche of people going forward, or is it again an event that people dealt with and have moved on from, or do you think it's living large in people still?
Yeah, look, I think it depends on the person. And as you can see, when we spoke to, or you might have noticed during the COVID period, there were some guys that handled it really well and some guys that didn't. I mean, the guys that we spoke to, you know, some of them thought it was fantastic because they were able to get more time off or spend more time with their family. And some of them felt it was terrible because they had, you know, big mortgages and they couldn't pay them, or they worried about their future. But, you know, if we think about the concept of resilience is really kind of the end point of the ability to coping with something new and being able to adapt to that. And this is something that we have, you know, that's inbuilt. It's evolutionary. It's from years ago in the savannah when, you know, we saw wild animals and we worked out when they came out to hunt and where they lived, and we worked out strategies, you know, coping strategies to deal with that. And it's the same thing here. So in a scenario like COVID, you can either take it one of two ways. And it depends on the vulnerability of the person that's involved. So, you know, if people are in situations of chronic poverty or, you know, long-term illness or whatever it happens to be, then another issue like a COVID is just going to knock them, you know, really knock them over. But if all those other things aren't there, then it's an opportunity to be able to see what's happening, adjust to it, cope, and then the next time something else comes along, you know, you build up some resilience. It's the same thing we do when we're flying. We have, they, you know, introduced to scenarios in the simulator, and then when we go out in the real world, hopefully we'll be able to deal with those. So it's, you know, it's got this two sides of the coin here, and it depends so much on the individual person. But for some people, I mean, I have had a client last year who was dealing with long COVID, and there's not a lot of information about long COVID out there, but that certainly has changed their attitude in terms of their ability to cope with any future illnesses or situations that, you know, might come along. So what we can do with them is continue to, you know, help build them up in ways that I've mentioned before, in terms of if they've got a negative narrative about what might happen in the future, you know, that may or may not be true. We tend to place a lot of emphasis on our thoughts, and we believe them to be true. So working on that with that person particularly was quite useful. But yeah, so it really depends on the person, and it can be positive and it can be negative. I think for many in the pilot community, it was a pretty good wake-up call, you know, regarding the fragile nature of the security of the work that we sort of felt would be a lifetime profession. So from that point of view, I think it was very kind of instructive for people.
Okay. Now, just to finish, just with regard to PAN, so obviously, you know, you work within PAN. Can you just remind our listeners about the service that PAN provides and how to access it?
Yeah, sure. So PAN is now, we've got a website, but we're going to update the website. So hopefully that will be happening in the next few months. So you can either go to the website Or alternatively, you can just talk to, on that website, there's, you know, a list of PAN members and contacts for those PAN members. And also, just when you're flying, you might notice that there are pilots there that have a lanyard that's got PAN written all over it. So you can approach them, you know, preferably not on final approach, but at some point, maybe after the flight, or even, you know, having start a conversation maybe during the flight that can be continued after the flight. So, yeah, so run into them there. And the way the system works for us, if we make contact or somebody makes contact via the website or via personally on a trip, is that the PAN members are trained. So we run these workshops. I've got this wonderful person who's my partner when we run workshops for PAN, and she's a professor of psychiatry, actually, at New South Uni with 30 years experience, very, very experienced and a lot of expertise in the area of mental health. And so we run these workshops. And so the PAN members are trained in basic counseling skills, basic listening skills, active listening skills, and they can generally sit with someone and support them and listen to them. And a lot of the times that's enough. But if it's not enough and they feel like it's, you know, beyond their pay grade, as it were, they'll refer on to maybe the state coordinator who's got a little bit more experience. And if that doesn't work, then they might refer it on to me, and I can sort of, you know, it's a bit like a triage service. I can assess the person. And generally, if it's a training issue or, yeah, an area of something that they're struggling with regard to the company, that's usually enough. But if there are some serious psychological issues that need some long-term therapy, then I'll refer them on to, you know, this team of psychologists that we have in every state. And the good thing about that is that if people want to avoid, you know, stay under the radar and they don't want to go through their GP and get a mental health plan, then they can do this. And we offer about 4 or 5 sessions at no cost, and people can discover whether therapy or longer term therapy is a good thing for them if they're really struggling with issues. And that's how the system works.
And yeah, obviously, yeah, it's all confidential too. I mean, I guess that's the real strong tenet of the whole thing, that it is confidential if people decide to contact PAN.
Absolutely. It doesn't go anywhere. I mean, that's like a, you know, it's the mainstay of the whole organization, and PAN members have to sign something to that effect. And, you know, the usual thing that we say in psychology about confidentiality is the only time that can be breached is if there's a safety issue. So if, you know, someone is going to come to harm, or with either themselves or somebody close to them, or if there are children involved that could be harmed, you know, that's the time when we might start to consider, you know, making a judgment call. But it's very rare, or hasn't happened in my, you know, my time there. And I don't think it's really happened in terms of when I spoke to Marcus Romanek, who used to do this work. But yeah, so basically, yeah, confidentiality is king.
Now, is there anything you wanted to finish with, or any sort of final message you wanted to give to the pilots on this really fascinating sort of subject?
Yeah, not really. Well, maybe just don't be afraid to reach out. You know, I think it's great if anybody does reach out, because it takes a bit of, you know, courage. And as we talked about earlier, pilots tend not to do that. We just tend to put our heads down and keep moving forward. But sometimes, you know, that doesn't really work. And then if you fall over, you know, there's greater chance of that happening if you don't reach out. So, yeah, I would encourage people to do that. We've got a great team working for, you know, working with PAN. They're all volunteers. We'll accept the psychologists who are obviously paid. But, yeah, it's a very powerful team, and people can be assured that it'll all be confidential and they'll be supported. That's what we're doing. We're walking with people. We're not, you know, we're not making their problems go away, but we want them to know that there are people here who care about them and will support them and help them get through whatever it is they're trying to get through.
All right. Well, that's a fantastic message to finish on. Thanks again, Andrew, for your time. Look, it's a really interesting chat. It may be something we can even explore further with you if people want us to delve a bit deeper. But in the meantime, thank you very much for your time. It's been very fascinating.
No problem at all. Lovely to chat. And, yeah, anytime.
No worries. Well, thanks again to Andrew. And as I said, we hope that a little bit different, a little bit off piece from maybe what the stuff we normally cover, but we think that it is definitely something that is hopefully of value to those particularly undertaking training courses, and even those just in your day-to-day working lives. So we hope you found some value in that. That's all from us today. Thanks for tuning in to another episode, and fly safe and stick with it.